Like, I always joke that I'm the Cousin Eddie of the Aspen Institute, where everyone's like, we don't know where we got this one, but she's always around in her RV.
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound, conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. In some ways, LB Prevett had a tough childhood. She worked long hours on her family's chicken farm in Wilkes County, North Carolina. She was bullied at school for being gay, and in fact was attacked as a teenager at Merlefest, Wilkes County's annual music festival. She left for out west not long after. But Wilkes County soon called her home, and she returned determined to make a better life for herself and others on the margins. Her efforts landed her on the radar of the Aspen Institute, a think tank designed to work on problems at the global and local levels. LB directs a series of community projects in Wilkes County that are designed to help people who need it and bring the community together. She also co-owns a bar in Wilkesboro called Merle's. She has thought long and hard about ways to bring together our divided country. And she also has a few thoughts about J.D. Vance. Here's our conversation. LB Prevett, you grew up and live in Wilkes County, North Carolina. For people who haven't been there, don't know about it, tell us what it's like.
Wilkes County is a small town. It's in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains. We're a town where a lot of really cool things started. Something that's unique about us, where we had, you know, one of the first NASCAR tracks. Lowe's Hardware had started here. But when I was growing up, it was just kind of empty. It seemed like the days of factory work were gone and the bigger corporations had left by the time I was in middle school toward Charlotte. So it's a scenically beautiful small town that just kind of seemed empty.
And also maybe not moonshine invented there, but certainly a well-known place because of Junior Johnson and people like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely hold the moniker, you know, the moonshine capital of the world. I think Floyd, Virginia would try to like fight us for it back and forth, but we claim it for ourselves, absolutely.
And you grew up on a chicken farm, right? What was that like?
So I grew up on a chicken farm, and when I say chicken farm, I try to always get folks to have the idea of the scale. So we had what's called layer houses, so where we actually collect the eggs. We had, you know, hens, but we had about 30,000 chickens. So we had three houses that each held around 10,000 birds. When it was peak season, we were picking up, you know, over 20,000 eggs a day comfortably just by hand that came down the conveyor belts. It was a really interesting way of living that I love about farm living or rural living in general, where there's just always stuff to do. I still call it piddling with my friends when they're like, what are you doing today? And I'm like, I'm just piddling, where maybe I'll make a new bench. Maybe I'll repair, you know, something that's broken in the house. Maybe I'm just cleaning, but it's just kind of like you're staying in motion. That's how it kind of always felt, where there was the regimen of, you know, you pick up eggs in the morning, noon, afternoon. And then the evenings, there was, of course, grass to mow or cows to tend to and things. But you're very much just filling it with kind of piddling time, it felt like, growing up.
Did you get tired at some point of ever seeing eggs again?
Oh, I haven't eaten eggs in like a decade. Like, it's
not really.
Like, I had this kind of epiphany. So I used to work for Lowe's in an office that they had here in the Wilkesboro, and we had a canteen. And I was really health focused at the time. So I'd have my omelet, you know, with veggies like every morning. And I would cover it in hot sauce because I just hated eggs. And I was like, why are you still eating eggs? I was like, LB, you're like grown. You're like 25. You just don't have to eat an egg again. And so I just stopped and started just getting the like veggies, you know, kind of on the side as breakfast with the protein. And yeah, I haven't really. There's been like a couple times since then. There's actually recently I was on a trip with some friends and I was like, maybe I'll eat an egg. Like, let me try it. And I covered it with enough like salsa, kind of got through it. And then I got bold, took too big of a bite. And I was like, absolutely not. Like, cannot stand it. So yeah, I would, nope, won't do it.
And were you the kind of kid who, as you were growing up doing that, couldn't wait to get out of town?
I don't know. You know, sometimes I think back because I don't know that I knew how to choose for myself at that point. I was definitely the kind of kid that people saw as like smart and having opportunity in front of them. So all I knew was that I was going to get out. I had to get out. That was the only path kind of presented. I don't know that I necessarily wanted to get out. I think growing up, as we did, poor and rurally isolated, I don't know that I even knew there was something different. I just knew there was here and out, and I had to make that jump.
Oh, well, and speaking of out, you're gay, and is that something that you knew and your family knew early on, or how did that sort of evolve in you and your family?
Yeah, I always talk about coming out as I was never really in, just kind of like was, you know what I mean? I think it's something if people had ever thought critically about of me, they were like, oh yeah. And even as getting older, in conversation with my grandmother, and she's like, I always like was worried this was going to be true. So even in the like rejection, there's still the acknowledgement of like they read that very early on. So yeah, I'd always been, out. There wasn't really conversations until I was older. There is a my other grandmother, I remember when I was an older teen, her looking at me and being like, Larbeth, I'm talking about her, my grandfather and her, and she's like, we knows you's a lesbian. And that was like the more I was like, I guess, thanks, Granny.
But I've read some things about you that, because maybe of your sexuality or other reasons too, you had a difficult time, right?
Yeah, but like my family was always either, I think, in the like, we're never going to talk about it, like the big open secret. And school, like, there's no such thing as an open secret. It's the like whisper campaign and things that I thought were, minimal. I see now, like, they're never minimal to a kid. Like, just even hearing the whispers and the rumors and the things about yourself going around were really hard to go through. And then, of course, like culminating into a pretty like violent attack when I was 17.
So attack, if you don't want to talk about it more than that, you don't have to, but like somebody beat you, or what happened there?
Yeah, no, it was actually a Merlefest weekend, kind of a bonfire after the music, like all the local kids kind of do. And I was there with a pretty big group of folks and walked out to grab a jacket from a car and just someone swung a branch and knocked me out there in the woods. I don't know for how long and such. And just kind of came home and just drove myself home and didn't really know what to do, which is kind of in this like incredibly numb shock of it all, right? It's just not something I'd ever really anticipated or like knew what to do with or thought was a real possibility. That was just kind of then. I didn't feel comfortable at the time really talking about it and sharing it with people. I told my dad because I had a really nice gash above my eye, and I told him I'd fallen getting out of the shower. Yeah, that was a story I went with for a while, and had slowly like there was friends over life, like close friends at time that I would tell and like talk about it, but I just didn't know what to do about it. When you grow up in kind of a town where it's one thing to feel othered because I am different, I was the openly queer kid or the kid people knew to make the most fun of then, but when it was like I really needed help, it wasn't just like hearing people's whispers and rumors, I was like, oh, I don't know where to process this. Like, I don't know how to talk about this. I don't know where to go. And I really didn't know where to go, and it's not that I'm that old. This was, early 2008. So this wasn't that long ago, but like, there's no such thing as a teacher with a flag or an ally pin or anywhere you were going to go in Wilkes County that you knew you could say it and it wouldn't be like worse.
And so, how did you process it? Did you basically just swallow it, or what?
Pretty much like yeah, I mean, I really did. It's yeah, just kind of was like, well, this is a thing and I'm gonna look at that later and just kind of, set it to the side. My therapist isn't great at compartmentalizing. So I was like, I'm gonna give myself a ribbon for that, whether or not it's a good thing. Yeah, I think it was helped by the fact that like, summers on the farm and things like I was home for the most part. I wasn't out or doing things, and this was spring, so I just had to get through a school year. And then it was off to college where I could pretend like this wasn't something that had ever happened, and that's just kind of what I did for a long time.
And not too long after that, like a year or so maybe, your dad died, and that sounds like coming back for his funeral was sounds like maybe kind of a turning point for you.
Yeah, my dad died at the start of my sophomore year. Yeah, it was a turning point because I'd stayed just really afraid. I mean, I stayed afraid for long after this, don't get me wrong, but and I did carry a lot more anger, right? Of this just, I don't know, I mean, of course, righteous anger. I just didn't know where to put it. Like I just had all of this. And I'd always felt very othered, right? Like I was never, obviously for the main reasons of like, queer, poor, but also in a rural town, There were only three girls my age in my church, which is the center of like social life. And the other two girls are incredibly sweet. They're good people. I really love them. They were always incredibly kind to me. But they're both like 5'4" and look like Barbie. And I'm like 6 foot and like brown hair and sing like bass. So it was just like always kind of not quite right in all of those communities, even within my close-knit farm community. Yeah, when dad died and I came back to the funeral, those folks who kind of always held me at arm's length because I wasn't quite right, like I didn't quite fit in, they suddenly were just like showing up for my dad's kid. They were just there for like Chris's daughter, and they were there to make sure because he was so beloved and so part of it. And I think it's for the first time I started thinking about like all the ways people see me, not just the way that I've been carrying, right? I've been so terrified of this part of me, but then thinking about all the parts of me that are lovable and openly loved with those communities as well.
And that's kind of turned into you deciding to stay home and make a go of it to do something there then.
Not quite. Like I thought about staying home. I still wasn't quite there. I actually moved out west for a couple of years, and I think it still needed some processing time. Like it still was, because even with dad dying, coming back home, we had a farm, so it's the like trauma of losing a parent and kind of processing all that. But there was also like a farm to run and things to do and bills to pay and me to honestly figure out like adulthood, because that went like my parents. So suddenly you're 19, like I've got to take care of myself. But I didn't really have any transition period into doing that. I was out in school in Nevada. That was where I kind of set my sights back home. And it was because out there, being in a larger city and a larger university, and there were so many like more queer affinity or organization groups. And I was at this event where we were working with queer youth, and there were just more adults there than kids. And it just kind of like broke my heart and had this light bulb go off of like, it doesn't really matter that I'm here. Like it's good that I'm here and I'm glad that I'm here. And I'm sure I'll make personal connections that only I can make, but it doesn't really matter that I'm in this room right now. But it would matter if I was home. It would matter if I did this where I was raised. It would matter if I saw this growing up. And that's eventually what just led me back home, just to be a person who like lives here and exists here, that kind of kept growing year after year.
You had this idea to kind of give people back home the feeling that you had out there. How do you start doing something like that? Like what got you off the ground?
It's hard because I really did just come home and I'm just friendly. And so it wasn't even like organized with any thought. I guess you could say that's the first prong of my attack: become your likable gay friend, right? That's the first, like, how I fight homophobia of like, well, if I'm your friend and you're like, oh, I actually love this like queer person that I'm in relation with, that's hard.
I have to have ask, stop and ask a question about that. On one of your bios I read somewhere, you listed yourself as an aggressive friend. So, what's your definition of that?
I'm just really talkative, I guess. Like even now, like when I'll be working at my bar and folks sit down and they may be quiet and just there for a drink, and I'm like, oh, but that's what the inside bar is for. Like if you're outside with me, like I'm here to talk with you. And you'd be amazed at how many folks just like are waiting to have conversation invited. As well as I'm aggressive to be like, let's get a coffee or let's do this. Or even though I've been much busier the past year of my life than I've ever been. So it's become much more of like, I may not have time, but I will aggressively spam your inbox with memes while I'm scrolling somewhere. Like just staying present with people's life and staying accessible would probably be it.
So you're the aggressive friend, and then how are you starting to make connections when you're back in Wilkes County to sort of get some stuff off the ground?
It starts always kind of like wherever I've worked has always been a hub of just like making connections through like my coworkers there, which is weird to work remote now. But at the time, I was a barista, so it just became like the people I worked with and then their roommates and all of our friends. And we just got together and we actually spent a lot of time at my farm. And it was funny because it was without TV or internet and things like that didn't exist there. So we had to just talk and hang out, which feels very normal to me, having grown up without cell service or these things, around that area. And when you take remove the distractions of folks start connecting, it just kind of became this, oh, I want to go hang out at the farm, or I want to go do that. And so that was really the second thing, was like once you've been an aggressive friend and you get folks in space, like they had my full attention. when I was with them, and I had their full attention. After that, I was working at Lowe's, which was kind of great because I was a facilitator. So I was a trainer, and I had these classes that rotated around every few weeks. I'd have a new group that came in for a few weeks. And it gave a lot of exposure to very much like folks who worked in office, so geographically of this area, plus an hour, give or take. And in that role, for so many folks, I'd realized they'd never met an openly gay person, which I just kind of would forget about. But also then I was like, well, LB, who do you know? I was like, oh, well, how many people do I know that live here that are also like openly queer? Which is a much different answer now than I had 10 years ago. But at that time, that was kind of the work. And it was folks coming up to me after class that, can I talk to you about something? And wanting to share probably way more than they should have for in a professional setting. But I was like, we have resources. Like, I don't really know where to direct you. Thank you for sharing that with me. But yeah, that was really kind of the first organizing, was just living and being a good friend.
And what did it end up being organized into? What were a couple of things that you did sort of at the beginning?
That kind of nest became a campaign. I actually ran for county commissioner, which was, it's wild to think about, was 6 years ago now. But it was really cool because it was like my friends and people I knew suddenly, like, we all kind of had permission to give a damn about this place. Like, it stopped being a place that we just make fun of, right? We're like, well, what if we tried to fix it? What if we tried? What if we all got involved? And it kind of, not so much like my campaign, but a lot of other things were happening at the same time. As I was running Anchor Coffee, that was here in town, which was one of the first like young entrepreneurs, like people my age, like millennials, really like starting their own business, was getting off the ground here in town. Megan Barnett was starting Forward Wilkes, like a community organizing group. And so it's all these things were kind of convalescing at once that gave people both like a place to gather, a person who myself like knew about the local issues and what we were facing and how to kind of like, let's hope to do this. Someone like Megan who gave you a place to like put your resources and where you could go with it.
And how did all this, or how did you get on the radar of the Aspen Institute?
It's a small story. There was a person who worked on the staff for Weave, which is a program that was started at the Aspen Institute by David Brooks
David Brooks, the New York Times.
of the New York Times. And they were looking for communities to come interview and speak with. One of the staff at Weave had went to Davidson, so she'd reached out to an old professor and said, hey, do you know any communities around your area? And the woman at Davidson happens to be cousins with this woman in town, Miss Carol, who's like in her 80s. And Carol's like, yeah, you come on to Wilkes. We've got a lot like to check out. And Carol kind of put a list together for them of here's people you should talk to in the town, doing great things. I didn't actually know Carol, but she knew of me from running for office. So she had known me as like a young candidate and seen kind of the campaign and videos and such. And so that was what had put me there. And then, yeah, I showed up at a dinner because I accidentally brushed David off for a week because David Brooks is the name of our high school football coach and choir director. And everyone kept telling me that David Brooks was wanting to meet. And I was like, I'll talk to Coach Brooks like later. I'm busy right now. Like, I've got a campaign. Like, I was working full time and running a countywide campaign. I was like, I'll talk to Coach Brooks later. And then it turned out it was David that I was brushing off. So, yeah, David came down to Wilkes to visit us. We gathered with the Weave staff, and the original team there, and had a bunch of what they call weavers, or folks that are kind of trying to work on the community aspect of community, all together from Wilkes. And we just had a dinner. Yeah, it was just bringing together a bunch of locals. And that was how we had first been introduced to all of them.
And so you've been sort of there, but sort of representing this area out there as well. Like you go to events out there and that sort of thing.
I touched the Aspen Institute in a couple different ways. One is through the Weave program, where I have spoken with David about Weave myself, done a lot of work with them around like, how do we have these hard conversations? Speaking of opportunities around that, my personal experience quite a bit. And we've also last year, I've served as our community liaison for the Weaver Awards that we did in partnership with the Walton Family Foundation, which was this amazing direct awards that went to different individuals across the town, organizations, doing just work to help focus on bringing our community together, especially education sector. This year, we have different community liaisons. So really excited. My friend Greg Brady and Belly Marino, two wonderful residents of Wilkes, are managing that this year of another award cycle where Weave is back here with those awards. But then I'm also a fellow with the Aspen Institute, which is through the Civil Society Fellowship that began in 2019. So I was an inaugural fellow with that program. And that sends me out a lot as well. I feel like I always joke that I'm the Cousin Eddie of the Aspen Institute, where everyone's like, we don't know where we got this one, but she's always around in her RV.
Next up on Southbound, LB Prevett talks about how she makes her political preferences known.
And I generally don't talk politics. I have a bar in town. You'll rarely find me actually talking politics to people, but you'll find me in a shirt that says Protect Trans Kids.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with LB Prevett. You know, when I first heard that, you're doing stuff with the Aspen Institute in Wilkes County, it reminded me of that, like, salsa commercial where the cowboys are sitting around and they're like, the salsa's from New York City. And I just wondered how, in Wilkes County, that plays this philanthropic institution that I think of as being staffed, fairly wealthy people, and certainly in a wealthy place, how that plays coming back to Wilkes County.
I think you describing that commercial was pretty much my experience explaining these awards the first year. It's both that Appalachian rural tendency of like, who is this outsider, coupled with a name like Aspen Institute, where even though the Institute's headquartered in DC now, it's still the Aspen Institute. And I think there's really no way of describing those big kind of, for lack of a better term, like think tank type organizations without alarming folks around here. And even again, when they were bringing us a check, they did it made a huge impact in Wilkes County, not just the direct awards that they brought, but the reservation spent, reservation space that we used, Benton Hall, which is home to our Wilkes Playmakers and the historic school building, because Aspen was renting that and, able to pay a full cost, and they were able to get plumbing repaired and necessary things done in a building. It had a huge impact. People were still skeptical. It's like they're bringing us a check and they're like, I don't know about that. At the actual event that we, the big kickoff event to the awards last year, we had, 150 or so people, give or take, in our town that came out for the awards. And we had contacted every elected official, everyone involved. And we had one representative from any form of government show up at the event. So, like, people were still really reticent about it. I'm hoping that the work we did last year and them seeing what kind of projects were funded and how the awardees, who are people here in the community, like their neighbors, talk about the experience and going through it, helps us get a bigger turnout. But we were definitely ready to cut our nose to spite our face on that one for sure.
So what are some of the projects that got funded? What's some of the, I understand these are fairly small, right? Like 5,000 bucks here and there.
Yeah, they're all $5,000 awards that are delivered out to our neighbors. We had, Miss Susan was running the Wilkes Yoga Sisterhood. So she's a yoga instructor around town. So she did a year program for young girls of doing free yoga sessions and community outings, like connecting them to what, like, they would take them for a treat at the local coffee shop or the bakery. To Kia McCatherine, who I adore, did, I know she's one of our middle school principals, and she used her funding to help purchase the fee for athletic physicals for middle schoolers or anyone who wants to try out for a sport. That $75 a year school physical, I know, was a big deal to my parents that you had to pay for that annual sports physical. If there's kids who are wanting to play sports but don't have the gear to try out, to even try to make the team, they help cover that financial gap. Through there, we had a Bellarmino, another educator in town who was building an outdoor STEM lab. So just another learning classroom for her students. And so really just a bunch of kind of creative ways we could just embed, the lives, especially for school age kids here in the community.
At the national level and at the local level too, there's obviously been a long-term discussion about how divided we are as a country. How are you finding that as you do these little things and try to get people together kind of at ground level in a fairly rural county still? What are you hearing? How do you feel like it's going?
It feels like when we stay in the small and the close to home, we agree. And too often we're all getting pulled into these big conversations, the big national ideas and conversations. And I think folks have definitely lost their way of how to have conversations around it, because also for some folks, these are their human rights. Like, these aren't a like kind of conversation. This is a genuine, my life is in the balance, my rights are in the balance conversations that we're having with people. And I think that can help us stop seeing the humanity in each other. I think it's really easy with, I bite my tongue a lot when I'd like to go off because someone says something that's just not right. And I always try to assume that they don't know any better. And we're going to try to figure out how to politely correct this because I'm not going to let it go, but we need to talk about it. We are just hyper divided. It's hard to figure out how to talk to folks again. So I try to stay out of that. I'm trying to figure out how to word it, where folks always say, like, they try to stay out of the political. It's like, well, my existence is, political at all times. And I generally don't talk politics. I have a bar in town. You'll rarely find me actually talking politics to people, but you'll find me in a shirt that says protect trans kids. Or you'll find me in a shirt, that says rednecks for Black Lives. That's kind of, I just have an array of, this is what I'm wearing today, to where we don't have to have the conversation, where I stand. I find folks have rarely, if ever, commented on it to me in any way that I notice or say, because that is the thing about the South. We're driven by manners so much that I don't know what they say about me at the dinner table, but they probably won't say it to my face.
They say, bless your heart,
Absolutely, right? But I think what that does is it gives visibility. I think there's so many folks around the community who probably are more progressive than we speak up. The myth of the silent majority. I live in rural America. You're not silent at all. We hear you. Like, you guys are screaming all the time. But there is a, like, I'm always shocked at folks that come up to me that I find out are more progressive or like liberal. I'm always like, oh, even I forget that there's other ones here. That's what, at least that's how I do it. Don't really want to have the conversation with you, but I'm also going to make my views and what I do pretty public, so folks can find allyship.
So, as you mentioned a couple of times along the way, you're a part owner of this bar, Merle's. Is that for Merle Watson?
Yeah, it's after Merle Fest, kind of.
Merle Fest,
We
yeah.
all had different ties to the festival, with my co-owners, Mike and Aaron, as well. And we just kind of love the name. And we think of folks that grew up here or anyone that's a festival folk, Merle Fest is a rite of passage. And it's this beautiful time. It's a great event. It's, awesome headliners, wonderful spirit. But it's the only weekend a year Wilkes County was like that. And we're kind of like, what if we had a space that felt like that all the time? Where folks were kind of united for something bigger, and just here to enjoy fellowship and good music, and a good time with each other.
So I don't quite know how to ask this, but is it considered the gay bar there, or is it just like a bar where gay people happen to work?
Yeah, that's kind of where I jokingly answer. It's not, our clientele is not remotely close to like majority queer. We are in Wilkes County. It's, but I would say if you ask like queer folks within an hour, it's the gay bar, right? For us, it's like the place we know we can go. It's still the minority of the population, but I love of like that we have our bitter Southerner flag out back, our abide no hatred, and our clientele is still 90% straight. You know what I mean? And a lot of skewing older folks, honestly, as well, in the establishment. We love it. Everyone has a great time. Like, we were yet to have any issue or anything arise or any pushback on it. To where I think folks are always, can oftentimes be too afraid to take the first step because they're afraid of what would happen. And it's like, well, we did it. And it's been nothing but really good and really beautiful for all the folks that have been involved.
Do you feel like people possibly get a little more philosophical or maybe a little more honest after a couple of cocktails?
Oh, everyone thinks they're a philosopher after a couple cocktails, right?
I guess what I'm trying to get at, do you feel like, I'm not sure I'm going to say this right, do you feel like there's more commonality amongst the people there after everybody's had a drink or two?
Yeah, I think it's maybe not even after the drink or two, because we even pride ourselves on our zero proof, like, you know, non-alcohol, where we always say, like, come have a drink with us, alcohol's optional.
Right.
But I think when you're just sharing a beverage with someone, right, when you're sitting beside someone on a bar stool, you're just very similar. You know, you're both people at the same place and the same time and the same experience, hearing the same music. It's easy to make friends with a stranger. And now, yeah, for those who are drinking, of course, everyone's chattier a couple drinks in, right? We're just a little less stiff, a little less worried about making the motions of who I'm supposed to be, right? Am I acting like the good conservative, you know, business owner across town that I am, or that conservative lawyer in town? Am I playing the role right? And you just become like a guy at a bar or a person at a bar, and you start making friends with, you know, that lesbian that's bartending for you over there. You know, you kind of start connecting with folks because you start seeing the humanity again. You're stripped away of who you were before you came in.
So one thing I read in a couple of stories about you was that there was a New York Times story about Wells County that came out several years ago that hit you pretty hard. Could you sort of describe what that story was and your reaction to it?
Yeah, the article had came out, and it was like most things post 2016, trying to explain Trump and how we got him and why he's here. And communities like mine, you know, made a great sounding board of empty factories and as what they would describe as hopelessness all around. Yeah, and when the article came out, it made me really mad because it was embarrassing, right? Like, that's my home. Like, that's my home. That's where I live. That's where I'm at. And I think, though, I at times, too, have been someone who would decry Wilkes or kind of look down on it, or, you know, it's the place that you're supposed to be ashamed to be from type mindset. In the South, it's different when someone else airs your dirty laundry. Like, it's one thing when it's kept in-house to somebody else, but, like, how dare you? Like, how dare you, you Yankee, come in here and write that about us and then publish it in your paper? And the thing is, it described us as this kind of state of, like, anxiety, of this hopelessness of what we had been, which is true. Like, we had been a much more booming and populous town, but I knew a town that people were really happy to be here. Like, we were still choosing to be here, that we were doing really meaningful work. And more importantly, I knew, like, we didn't make our own damn problems. But unlike that article and J.D. Vance know about us, right? Like, it was still portrayed as this, it's our fault. We did it. We're just so sad. Look how broke they are and the terrible decisions you make. And it's like, well, yeah, but when you only got bad choices, of course you're going to make a bad choice.
You mentioned J.D. Vance as we speak. He's just been chosen to be the vice presidential nominee. And he's obviously made his name by writing Hillbilly Elegy, talking about his representation of Appalachia. I know that's something that you try to do as well and think a lot about. What are your thoughts on him?
And Tommy, I've hated J.D. Vance for a long time, and I don't know anyone involved in actual Appalachian studies from Appalachia in this region, involved in this work in this region, has anything kind to say about him. Literally the night before the announcement, my partner, who she's not familiar with, you know, Hillbilly Elegy and J.D. Vance, something came up about him, and I was like, I hate that guy. And she's like, what is it? And I started talking, and I was like, I can't even get in this conversation because I don't want to take up my night yelling about this guy. And then the next day he was announced. So she's like, is this who you were talking about? And I was like, oh my God. Yeah. He's still an outsider looking down a telescope at us. And he sold a story. He sold the same commodity of Appalachia that we always are, right? As a reason for our own failings. He sold the stereotype of us, you know, completely overlooking the way coal and big business have consistently decimated this area, consistently stolen from them, consistently oppressed them, the way our schools are consistently stripped of funding. Like, you know, in a rural area, you may, even outside of Appalachia or in Appalachia, you see like the Supermax prison facilities coming, like both as a way of adding population numbers into these rural red counties, you know, with numbers, and isolating incarcerated persons even farther from their loved ones to make it hard. Like, we just see our region continually being plagued, and it's the one place that people, no one will rush to defend. Like, nobody rushes to defend Appalachia. When I travel and speak, I'll often ask people, like, I want you to picture you're having a conversation with the absolute, like, dumbest man you've ever met, just ignorant. And why does he sound like me? It takes it past even like Southern, which has its own, shtick and stereotype that we have. But Appalachian gets no salvation, like once you are a hillbilly, even in the progressive left or those things, because I constantly hear like how hard it must be to be queer in Wilkes County. And I'm like, I find it way harder to be like a hillbilly in academic elite spaces. They are right. Like my neighbors, when they say like the left and liberal are elite, yeah, y'all are right. I once sat in a racial equity program, like in this online larger course with folks. When I'd said my name was, my name's Laura Beth. I don't mind being called Laura Beth by any way, but people pronounce it Laura and it drives me up a wall because that's just not my name. And so I told the director, the instructor, because she kept calling me like Laura Beth. And I was like, you can just call me LB or you can call me Laura Beth, but like that's not how my name's pronounced. And she just kept running it the whole class. And then when it was something to be read aloud, she's like, Laura Beth, will you please read it? I just love to hear that accent, and starts like laughing. And I'm like, dude, like I get it. But like, do you understand that this is its own like also culture and identity? And I think it's one that, as JD showcases, there's two truths. If he thinks he's a hillbilly, then great. You sold yourself out and erased your entire identity to become a new person. That's what they tell all of us to do. That you can't be smart and sound like us. You can't be successful and sound like us. You can't do any of that if you want to keep these. They're like incompatible ideals. But in reality, he just ain't a hillbilly and he just wrote about it and uses it as a scapegoat like everyone else does. They sell the idea of Appalachia to prevent ever having to look at what they've actually done. And I think they use us as such a way to erase racism. Right? Because they look at this white poverty, like, look, it's white people too. And it's like, yes, but like that doesn't excuse all of the other like systemic poverty and oppression that's happened on a racial level. I can't believe that's our vice presidential nominee. I just, what a world.
Do you have some like vision, like let's say the stuff you're doing in Wilkes County now, it catches hold and people love it and that sort of thing. 10 years from now, what would the Wilkes County that you would want to see, what would that look like?
10 years from now, I'd like to see a Wilkes. As a mountain town, you got to say, like, hopefully not too different. Gentrification's coming hard for all of us. I'd like to see a Wilkes that's still close, right? That's still small, like local. But, the folks that own here live here. I'd like that to stay true for us. I would also like to see more pride flags around town. I'd like to see black-owned businesses exist in general, here in the town. I don't foresee Wilkes County in 10 years realistically having any big like political, shift. We are pretty staunchly like conservative. I think that's okay. I just need you to see that like being good to your neighbor is also good business. Like being good neighbors and being welcome and inclusive to everyone actually is just good for the whole town. It's good for every business in town. It's good for everybody here. If we try to create a place where folks can exist as their whole authentic selves and feel in a small town, is something that I know folks crave. I have friends who've literally moved to Wilkes County on a whim, what they had told me after they moved here. And I'd met him campaigning back in the day. And he's from a small town in eastern Tennessee and been living in Wilmington. When him and his wife were looking to buy somewhere, he didn't want to go back home because he felt like since transitioning, he wasn't safe enough to go back. Like, it's one thing to pass and live through the world, another thing to go back to your hometown. But he missed the town so much. And he's like, but maybe Wilkes. Like, I know there's people in Wilkes. What if I moved here? And I'd be damned if they didn't. And they moved here to Wilkes and have a place where he's like, it feels like my home, but it's also my home. Like, I'm here with a queer family and hanging out, and it's a small town. And that's what I hope we just see more of, and kind of become a place where folks looking for that can heal.
Somehow I didn't make the connection until my conversation with LB Prevett was over. The bar she co-owns, works at, and loves is called Merle's, for Merle Fest, the music festival where she was attacked as a teenager for being gay. As she said in the interview, she still loves Merle Fest. So do I. It's a beautiful weekend of people coming together to enjoy music rooted in the South. A lot of those old bluegrass and country songs are murder ballads or tragic tales of love and loss. But to hear them sung and played is cathartic. Joy and suffering can come from the same place. L.B. Prevett worried when she was young that she'd have to leave Wilkes County to find out who she really was. It turned out who she really was back there in Wilkes County. She is changing her home place little by little from the inside out. That must be immensely satisfying work. And one of the byproducts is that now Wilkes County knows her for who she really is. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Lisa Wharf and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.